You are listening to the Human Rights Podcast, hosted by the Irish Center for Human Rights at the University of Galway. This is a platform for dialogue and debate on issues related to the human rights and international law. I'm Julia Collins, and on today's episode of the Human Rights Podcast, we will be joined by Professor Ray Murphy. Together, we'll be talking about children in armed conflicts. We will especially be focusing on the recruitment of children for armed groups and the multi-faced challenges of eliminating the recruitment and exploitation of children in conflict zones, digging into legal frameworks, the violation of international law, and the provided protections to safeguard the rights of these children. What I have learned in my undergrad course and in different modules in my LLM caught my interest to talk about children in armed conflicts. Before chatting with Ray, I wanted to introduce you to children in armed conflicts. First of all, I would like to give you a short introduction to the topic. Worldwide, we find several conflicts, including Ukraine, Syria, the DRC, and many others. Armed conflicts are terrible and have a massive impact on the civilian population. Children are a vulnerable group in armed conflicts. They face the death of family members and friends, or just injure themselves. However, children remain being recruited for armed groups today. We will hear more about this from Ray later. According to the report of the Secretary General in 2023, about 7,622 children worldwide are recruited and used by armed groups or armed forces. The Paris Principles defines a child soldier as any person under 18 years of age who is part of any kind of regular or irregular armed force or armed group in any capacity, including but not limited to cooks, porters, messengers, and anyone accompanying such groups, other than family members. The definition includes girls recruited for sexual purposes and forced marriage. It does not, therefore, only refer to a child who is carrying or has carried arms. According to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, which classifies as war crimes, the enlistment and use of children under the age of 15 years as combatants, whether in the armed forces of the state or in opposition forces. This reflects the prohibition of the recruitment or direct participation in hostilities of children under the age of 15 years in Article 38 of the CRC. But we will hear more about that later on. I will give you a quick introduction to our guest. Prof. Ray Murphy is a former Irish Defence Force captain. And is a professor at the Irish Center for Human Rights at the University of Galway. Furthermore, he is also affiliated with the International Institute for Criminal Investigations and Justice Rapid Response. From 2014 to 2019, he held significant roles with the EU Fundamental Rights Agency, Amnesty International, and the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission. Also, he has supervised training for various organizations globally and was awarded for teaching excellence. He also has vast field experience in conflict zones and has served in several capacities with international organizations and governments. Now to hear more from Ray. What methods do armed groups use to recruit children?
That's a complex question, Julia. I mean, what comes to mind immediately would be where armed groups such as the Lord's Resistance Army actually kidnapped children and forced them, conscripted them into their armed group and compelled them to act as soldiers and to fulfill various other capacities to support the armed group fighting in the field. So as you pointed out in your initial definition, there's a range of roles that are played by children associated with armed conflict. It's not just the combat role with the rifle on the front line. As anybody who knows anything about armed groups or militaries, actually the logistical supports that they need to maintain themselves in the field is huge. So a whole range of soldiers and children are used to maintain the armed group, and also, sadly, girls. And they are girls, they're not women. You know, these can be very young and under 18, and they can be captured for sexual purposes, can be into forced marriage and other exploitative roles. So, so that is the, you know, at one stage in northern Uganda, all the children in particular districts were rounded up every night to be guarded and protected because the threat was so great from the large resistance army. And that was very disruptive of family, social and educational life. And large numbers of children had been kidnapped, essentially. But the nature of conflict and the nature of the inequalities of the world mean that many cases children are compelled through the circumstances that they find themselves in to join some kind of armed group. You know, they, looking at it from the outside, they might be seen to be making a choice, but they're not. They're extremely vulnerable. The armed group may provide some degree of security. There may be even encouragement from parents sometimes for their children to be associated with an armed group because it will bring certain dividends such as security. And then you look at the situation, forced conscription doesn't arise in the case of Gaza. But today in Gaza, I don't know what the numbers are, but it's shocking to think of the numbers of children that are left without parents. And in the African continent, in the DRC and other places, in Somalia, when you don't have that family support, the next best thing is to join some group where there is some a sense of belonging and some degree of security. And maybe there's the prospect of a regular hot meal, the very basic things that we take for granted. So although it may seem from the outside like these children have a choice, they don't. They're forced by circumstances, by deprivation, by starvation, and the conflict, the consequences of the conflict. And so they seek out some degree of security and join these groups.
Thanks for your insight. Furthermore, what reasons do children have if they have the choice to join armed groups voluntarily?
Yeah, in my view, at the outset, I'd say that I can't really consider that any child under 18 that joins voluntarily really does actually do so on that basis. I believe that they're confronted with an appalling situation, and this is sometimes a question of it's a means of survival. And in a desperate situation, you make desperate choices. And in fact, sometimes you have no choice. This is a question of just being able to survive. So if you don't have the family support or the community support that every child needs, you will look for some other structure, some other place, and you will try to be part of a group and join with other children. You know, children naturally gravitate towards children of their own age. And I think they are joining to find security, to find shelter, to find food, and to have some purpose in life. And sadly, they're open to being exploited in so many different ways. I'm just reminded sometimes that you can indoctrinate children much more easily than you can adults, whose critical faculties will be more developed. And so actually they can become quite strong ideologues, very committed to very flawed causes, and feel that this is their main purpose in life. So, you know, when you encounter a child soldier, especially a child soldier or soldiers at a checkpoint in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, sometimes it's hard. You have to remind yourself that these are victims. These are first and foremost victims. When they're presenting hostile intent to you with a weapon and you're not quite sure how this encounter is going to unfold, you sometimes forget that they are first and foremost victims. And as an adult, especially as you get older in life, it becomes difficult to form that connection, that human connection, because you're so much older than they are and your life experience is so different from theirs. But you have to keep in mind always that these are children. These were vulnerable. They're still vulnerable, despite some of the things and atrocities they may actually be associated with. And they need our help. They need our support.
We have heard now about the recruitment and what challenges those children face, and that it is an issue. How does the recruitment of children for armed groups violate international law obligations?
There are a number of provisions in international law which prohibit the recruitment and in particular the conscription of children. First and foremost, there's the additional protocols to the Geneva Conventions. And despite prohibiting the recruitment and conscription below the age of 15, the actual threshold that states must meet is that they must take all feasible measures. And this is not the same as a strict and absolute prohibition, which would be a much stronger and better means of enforcement of the prohibition. And likewise, the Convention on the Rights of the Child, although it defines a child as 18 years of age and brought in an optional protocol prohibiting the recruitment and conscription of children in certain circumstances, it too doesn't actually go as far as it should. The conscription of children under 18 is prohibited, but again, states are only required to take all feasible measures not to do so, and it actually still permits the recruitment of children below 18 years of age. And the requirement is, of course, that anybody under 15 doesn't take a direct part, any child under 15 doesn't take a direct part in hostilities. But again, the obligation is that states take all feasible measures. And oddly, the protections in non-international armed conflicts as regards non-state actors are stronger. So there is a lot more that could be done at an international level. And before we leave the international level, probably the most effective means of preventing children being recruited is if you persuade states to bring it into their national law. And in fact, it might surprise listeners to know that Ireland only brought in a law prohibiting the recruitment of children below 18 years to defence forces only about 15 years ago. And that was after a significant and long campaign to raise the age to 18 years. You have to try to bring them with you. There's no point in enacting international treaties which may not actually have an impact on the ground. So, I mean, there are non-governmental organisations and UNICEF, etc. They do really good work in having children released from non-state actors and reintegrating them, a programme of disarmament and reintegration. And the challenges for children are very different than they are for adults, and the challenges for girls are different than they are for boys, and the challenges for a child in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and the Kivu problems will be different from the challenges actually of a child in another province, because you've got to remember a country like the Democratic Republic of the Congo is the size actually of Europe, of Western Europe. So the main thing I'd like to see is a stronger prohibition enacted into law. I'd like to see international humanitarian law to raise the acceptable age for enlistment to 18 years. I'd like to see a much stronger prohibition expressed in the Convention on the Rights of the Child and on the optional protocol for children in armed conflict. And I'd like to see states that have entered reservations, like despite the weak legal framework, still, I don't have the numbers to hand, but a large numbers of states in particular have entered reservations with regard to the specific responsibility not to recruit below the age of 15. So that's quite surprising. You've got to use the stick and carrot approach, because, you know, the United Nations and international treaties, they do good work. It is important, but you still have to persuade the non-state actors and indeed the states involved in this practice that it is better, it is a more humane, it is more in accordance with international standards and international human rights to respect the rights of the child and respect their childhoods. And one of the sad things in conflict zones and in many parts of the world, through the impact of conflict, but also through the impact of economic inequalities, you meet many children who have had no childhood. To survive that period of time, you know, they are like small adults in many ways. They are extraordinarily streetwise. And it's the desperation of their situation that requires them to be so in order that they survive.
Thank you very much. We heard a bit about legal instruments already. What are the key legal instruments and how do they apply to children in armed conflicts?
Yeah, that's a good question. The first key legal instruments for any situation of armed conflict are the Geneva Conventions. Sadly, they don't mention children in armed conflict or child soldiers. There are some provisions in the conventions, for example, if you've detained children, that you have to take into account when you compel prisoners to do work, which probably may surprise some listeners, but it is permissible to compel prisoners of war to do certain work, that you have to take into account their age. So you can't compel somebody at 10 or 12 years of age to do the work that an adult would be expected to do. So the protections for children under Geneva Conventions are minimal to non-existent. The additional protocols to the Geneva Conventions, which apply to both international armed conflicts and non-international armed conflicts or civil wars, do provide certain minimal protections. But again, they're very weak. And the rule is that you may recruit under the age of 15. So you may not recruit, under the age of 15. So it's that 15 years of age rule is replicated. And states are only obliged in the situations of international armed conflicts to take all feasible measures not to recruit below that age. But taking all feasible measures would allow states to actually say, well, we did all we could, and we, you know, whereas a clear absolute prohibition is what's required. And it's also required to raise the age from 15 to 18. And as I said earlier, the most recent enactment of international criminal law, the statute of the Rome Statute that governs the operation of the International Criminal Court, in order to have that statute adopted, it repeated the requirement, the permissibility of recruiting from 15 years upwards. And the reason behind that is the statute was a compromise. It took decades of work to get to that stage. And so all states compromised on certain things, and it was felt that if they actually tried to put into the statute what's called the straight 18s rule, that you couldn't recruit to below the age of 18, that states would not have agreed to the adoption of the statute, and later it would not have been ratified by so many states. So, it's easy sitting here to criticize the states. I wasn't there. Sometimes, you know, the enemy of the good is the perfect. And the protections for children, both under international humanitarian law, under international criminal law, and to a large extent under international human rights law, is significantly deficient and very weak. And it's something that needs to be addressed. And there are groups that are advocating for this. But progress has been quite slow.
We heard already a bit about international humanitarian law. What is IHL, and how does it provide a protection for children engaged with armed groups?
Yeah, the protection, international humanitarian law is the legal framework or the laws that apply in any situation of armed conflict. So I'm speaking here from a nice studio in the University of Galway, and we're in a peaceful situation. So international humanitarian law doesn't apply. There's no armed conflict. So we're talking about children associated with armed conflict. So obviously the most important legal framework is international humanitarian law. And it's usually concerned with the conduct of hostilities, the targeting of civilian objects. And in this instance, it is important for children, because, again, I'd point to the two conflicts that are taking place as I speak. The conflict in Ukraine, where actually the International Criminal Court is investigating the forced displacement of children and the kidnapping of children by the Russian Federation and the taking of them from eastern Ukraine to Russia. But as I'm speaking, the conflict is taking place in Gaza, and that's having horrendous consequences for the civilian population. But in particular, the impact on children is impossible to quantify. Attacks on schools and other protected objects directly impact children. So in that sense, children are affected maybe more than many other groups. And as I already alluded to, there are many children left without any relatives, not just their mother and father, but actually their siblings and their other families. Because in the Palestinian culture, the family isn't the nuclear unit that we'd associate with in the Western world. It's a broader It's broader. But to be left with no surviving family members is incredible and difficult to consider the consequences and the consequences for the community, for the survivors, but for the children who are the most vulnerable. Now, the one positive thing I would say of my experience of children is an odd thing to say when we're looking at children in armed conflict is children are incredibly resilient. But they need care, attention, they need professional people because they are going to be, like, many will be physically disabled, which compounds the challenges of surviving in such an environment. But they will all be traumatized. You cannot but be traumatized by what's happening. And that will need a lot of professional attention and care into the future. And right now, actually, they don't have a shelter, don't have a home to live in. Some of them don't have any food. They haven't access to medicines, to anesthetics. So that situation is as desperate as we can get. And there are now reports that people, you know, civilians are starving, but their children, not just hungry. The word being used is starvation. And, you know, I've seen the consequences of famine. And I would argue that many famines have been man-made. And the consequences are not, you know, are not just environmental, shall we say. But here, with absolute certainty, we can say that this is a consequence of the conflict. This should not be happening. We should not, as human beings, be standing by and witnessing this every night on our televisions. And, you know, even as I speak, some countries have withdrawn humanitarian aid to the one UN agency that has the capacity to deliver something to children and others. And they're saying, well, we're not doing so. I'm not going to go into the reasons why, but I think it is wholly unjustified, immoral, and absolutely wrong.
That's unfortunately the reality. And we heard about all those issues and talking about armed conflicts. How can listeners contribute to the efforts to end the use of children in armed conflicts and support affected communities?
So listeners must advocate on behalf of children in armed conflicts. I mean, there are a number of NGOs that are working in this field. There's Save the Children, which has got a very strong international presence. But there are others that especially who monitor the UN activities in this field. And the UN, since 1999, began to pay much more attention to the consequences of conflict on children. And now there's a special representative of the Secretary General who reports regularly to the General Assembly and to the Human Rights Council. And then there's monitoring and reporting mechanisms on certain conflicts, or they focus on certain conflicts and they focus on certain types of crimes. Obviously, killing and maiming of children would be a major issue. Unfortunately, there is significant levels of sexual violence associated with armed conflict, and children are a victim of this. And interference with education and access to health and all those other things. So what we need is to ensure that, because the United Nations has the legitimacy and the credibility and the resources to highlight these problems. And also it has access where others will not have access. So it is important that this particular issue is not politicized. And it does get politicized. Some states exercise their political clout to ensure that they're not, it's not officially called a blacklist, but the Secretary General issues a list of states and parties that violate the rights of children. And there's a lot of pressure sometimes on the Secretary General not to list certain states. Now, non-state actors wouldn't have that degree of influence to be able to change the Secretary General's mind. And like some years ago, for example, Saudi Arabia was going to be listed as a violator. And it exerted huge pressure on the Secretary General and the United Nations, in fact, threatening to withdraw all funding. And Saudi Arabia is a very wealthy country, so it would give significant funding to UN agencies. And It looked for a time as if they were going to succeed, but ultimately they didn't. And it's the non-governmental organizations that monitor the operation of the Secretary General's Special Representative and the agencies like UNICEF and the monitoring and reporting mechanisms to make sure they're transparent and they're fair and they don't allow political issues to compromise, you know, what is to me a very black and white issue. And I'd be the first at my age, I accept that there are many grey issues in life. But for me, a child is a child. And if we cannot protect our children, we cannot call out non-state actors and states for violations of children's rights, for killing, maiming, and all the other types of crimes, then what's the point in any of the human rights issues? You know, this is clearly something that there can be no compromise on.
Thank you very much, Ray. So today we heard about the importance of international law and how to protect children in armed conflicts and also when it comes to the recruitment for armed groups. We also learned a lot about what the challenges are and the issues we face as the international community to maybe stop using children in armed conflicts and to stop starvation and to stop all the pain those children face when it comes to the loss of family members. Maybe they have to leave the country to be safe. So thank you, Ray, for joining us today and for the information you provided us. You have been listening to the Human Rights Podcast. The podcast is produced by staff and students at the Irish Centre for Human Rights at the University of Galway and supported by the University Centre for Excellence in Teaching and Learning. This episode was produced by Julia Collins and Ray Murphy.